After 25 years in the fashion industry, I've realized that fashion is not really about the clothes, it's about the people. I'm Laura Van Root Poole, and this is What We Wore. Sitting down with Marie-Helena Tyack is always an incredible experience, and I asked her to come back on the podcast to share more on the power of stones and spirituality. I hope you're able to feel the way she channels beauty through her words and her craft during this episode. Marie-Lynn, I was telling you, we've had so much feedback and people have loved our first conversation many years ago, really. It was probably 4 years ago.
I think even more.
Maybe,
It's when my book came out in 2019, I imagine.
Really?
Yes. Yeah. I remember last time.
It's one of our most listened episodes, and you're really nice to come back and talk to me again. I'm glad I didn't scare you away too much. Thank you for coming here to Charlotte, and thank you for that beautiful supper last night. We had such a nice time with the jewels and with all of your clients. It was really beautiful.
Oh, thank you. I always love the way you do the dinners. It's so beautiful.
Thank you.
It's always very refined and sophisticated. I think it's amazing to see.
We know that you're coming from a place that's not the South, and so we try to serve a little bit of a Southern meal, and it's been received either way, but you're always really appreciative of it. You like the fried chicken, I think.
Also, I love eating the food from the country where I'm visiting. It's much more interesting. But I always like the way you put things together. I think the most important thing in life is harmony. And when I come to your place, what I love is the way you're creating harmony beyond the way the lady dress and also beyond the space. The energy of harmony is peaceful and it makes people calm down. And I think we need to, the talent that we have, I suppose you and I, is to bring beauty to this world and to create harmony to make it the world more, less crazy.
Yeah.
And it's very important we do it, even so it seems so futile. Because it's only clothing or it's only jewelry, still it brings something to people.
Yeah, thank you. I know you do that for me for sure.
I always remember Cocteau. You know Jean Cocteau, who I loved. He said that the privilege of beauty are immense, are huge, and they touch people who are not even aware of it. And I think such an interesting things to understand, because, you know, we could think that what we do is not so meaningful, but in fact it is, because anything that brings beauty touch people to their heart. And this is what I feel about the stones.
We remind the listeners where you're from and where you grew up. You have such an interesting childhood. And I think it really did bring you on a journey to where you are now.
Yes. So I was born in Libya in 1964. I don't have memory of Libya because I must have left. I was age two. I was brought up by an Italian nanny also. I think that's influenced my taste in food. But my place in India is very similar to what you the place I used to live in Libya.
Really?
So it's full of pink bougainvillea and those terraces, a whitewash, you know, the big sun. So then we went after Libya. We lived in Beirut, which at the time was the most amazing place. It was supposed to be the Saint-Tropez of that part of the world. And we were very, very lucky. We were going to, the three sisters were going to the Collège Protestant Français. And it was, you know, with our little uniform. Actually, we would hike up the uniform because it was a fashion of a miniskirt at the time. And my mother was very glamorous. You know, she was a bit like between Anouk Aimée and Jackie Onassis.
Yes.
Beautiful.
Very beautiful.
And she would get dressed up every night. And I think that, you know, I don't know if your mother was the same, but I think that's how we learned dressing up, because she would tell us, so what should I wear tonight? And she had the hairdresser, because at the time, you remember, the woman wearing chignon, she had the hairdresser coming every night. She lived in the same building to do her hair.
I love that.
So that was quite like, you know, I think very glamorous. And actually, when we left Beirut, we had to leave because of the war. And, you know, I think that was something which I didn't realize the impact that it had on me, but I think it was really, really terrible. But we left in June when the school was over and the war had already started, and we thought we'd come back in October. And they stole, of course, the apartment was broken down, and, they took all my mother's evening dresses. It's so bizarre. I mean, you think it's a war, but they took all the evening dresses.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah.
Even so, back, and that was in the
75, I think. Okay. The war started, was it 70? Yeah, I think it was 75.
And then you came back to Paris? Or?
Then we came back. I had the first, we came back, we were in the countryside in the southwest of France with my grandparents. And we went to this school. And it was, you know, I'd never felt winter. And it was so bizarre. I was always raised up in hot countries. That's why I love India, because it's hot. So no winter. And then also we just didn't fit. And I think for my sister, who was 2 years older than me, it was very traumatic because she, we were just out of place. It was like two little princesses, you know, we like very like little pretty dresses and like all the country kids.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was so bizarre. So the headmaster wanted to see my mother. She said, you can't keep the kids here. You know, it's just, it's not for them.
And so where did you go?
And then we moved to Paris.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And what was it like living with your grandparents? Had you known them? You'd come in the summers to see them.
Yeah. I love living with my grandparents. And it was, it was an amazing time. And, and I think it was nice for my mother to be with her parents and everything. And no, that part we love, but the school, we're like completely misplaced. We just didn't know. And then we moved to Paris and it was Paris in the late 70s. Okay, still very glamorous. Mm-hmm. And, I was very lucky to be able to go out and see all the beautiful. I mean, when I see the image actually on Instagram, I don't know if you follow Le Palace. On Instagram, you should.
Yeah.
I was very naughty. I would climb out of my window, age 16, every parent's nightmare, and go to the bain douche and go to the palace. But it was very glamorous at the time.
Yeah.
And there was no cell phone, so people were, let's say, they would really go and have a good time. But I was so lucky. I saw Prince, and he was. I mean, at the palace, they had the most amazing concert.
Yeah.
And all those famous people that, they were not so famous yet. And I got to see them because I was, because I was climbing out of my window. But there was a lot of people from that time that I still know and see. And if you look at the images, the amount of glamour of that time is amazing,
Your store ended up being on Rue de Tournon, which is where, wasn't it the Saint Laurent flagship was there?
Yeah, Saint Laurent was Rue Tournon, but there was also Walter Steiger. Do you remember Steiger?
Yes.
Which was designed by Karl Lagerfeld.
Yeah.
And I used to love the shoes. So I would save up so I could buy a pair of shoes from there. And there was Tan Guidicelli. Do you remember Tan Guidicelli? Mm-hmm. Tan, you would have loved. He would make such a glamorous evening wear. Mm-hmm. So he had his shop and Micmac. Micmac was probably one of the first ready to wear collection. So I don't think I'm that old, but there was not so much ready to wear for younger generation. No. That's why Agnès B was such a success, because it was the equivalent of the French Gap in a way.
Right.
I had to go to the dressmaker to get a thing stitched, or I would buy vintage, because there was there was nothing for our age.
I'm a little bit younger, but for me it was Naf Naf and Cacharel.
Yes.
And Cacharel.
Cacharel was wonderful.
Oh,
Cacharel was wonderful. Yeah.
Everything to me.
Yeah.
I went from Cacharel to Laura Ashley, which is sort of the same thing.
I had Laura Ashley, but it wasn't my best period. But that was before, because we had the Laura Ashley houses also.
Right.
You remember? So we would match the wallpaper and the fabric.
Exactly. Oh.
We would blend in. I have a picture of me at age 13.
Yeah.
It's just not my best look.
My bedroom is still fully Laura Ashley at my parents' house.
Yeah. You saved it? That's amazing.
Yeah, my parents haven't changed it.
Yeah.
It actually is really modern. I mean, it looks, it looks beautiful.
My bedroom in the countryside is still Laura Ashley.
It is really?
Yeah. But the bedroom is too small because I was, so I shifted to another one, but it's still like the wallpaper and a different print for the bed and another print for the curtain.
That's
so clever. It's such a shame actually this brand disappeared.
I know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was amazing.
Did your mother wear jewels in growing up in Lebanon?
My grandmother wore jewelry. My grandmother was very attached to jewelry, so I would always see more jewelry than my mother. But my mother took us, I think one of my first experiences of jewelry was going to the to a market in Beirut where you had all the jewelers, and she must have had a stone that she, or an old ring that she wanted to reset. So we went to the jeweler, and the jeweler gave my sister and I a small sapphire and a small ruby. I mean, they were so small that we lost them right away. But that is my first experience of having precious stones in my hand, and I loved it. that. And also my parents came back from Iran, and at the time the Shah was still there, and they had brought all the postcard of the treasure of the Shah. And to this day, I remember the crown of Faradiba.
Yeah.
And I remember all those jewels. And I remember I made an expose, I had a presentation about their jewelry. And that was one of the first memories, like the pearls and the big emerald and the sapphires. And I was fascinated.
When did it occur to you that you could do this for a job, for a lifetime?
It didn't occur to me, because sometimes things occur to other people, to the people around you, before you know about it. Okay, when I was 17, I thought of doing the GIA in New York. I mean, I spoke English because I'd been to English boarding school too, but I want, there's a lot of technical terms. So I thought, okay, I'm going to go to London and, spend 1 year in London to improve my English. Then I will go to the GIA. And in fact, London was an amazing time, because it was a time of the new romantic, Boy George. there was also at the time all the fashion show. It was the beginning of the London Fashion Week. Yeah. Do you remember the Buffalo Boys? No, Ray Petrie.
Yeah.
I mean, there was all this clique, Tom Dixon, all this clique of interesting people who were my friends. And I just, instead of going to the English classes, I got a job at Butler & Wilson, which was a jeweler, which was really hip at the time, because Nikki Butler had amazing friends, and I started working there as a salesperson. And then very soon Nikki said I could do the PR. So I was age 18, working with all my generation, because in England, all the fashion stylists were very, very young. Mm-hmm. And I was working with Hamish, who was working for the Australian Vogue at the time.
Yeah.
I was working with Joe McKenna. I was working, all that generation of amazing stylists who eventually moved to New York. Mm-hmm. I knew them from that time at Butler & Wilson. So I think that time I stayed in England for 10 years and I worked in the fashion industry and I learned a lot. I also worked a little bit for John Galliano. Mm-hmm. I worked for Richard James. But it was really an exciting time in the UK for fashion and for creative people.
And were stones always sort of in the mix?
At that time, no, stone were not so much there. I mean, Butler & Wilson, I must have stayed 2 years, and it was costume jewelry, and I learned again a lot, touching jewelry. I think it was when I worked for Philip Tracy, the milliner. Philip was a little younger than me, but he was so passionate about hats. And I would come in the morning and I would see what he had created overnight. And I would see that he was so, he would live and breathe for his hat. And I was like, I don't want to have the Sunday night blues. I want to do a job that I really love. And this is when I actually, I quit my job and I thought, okay, I'm going to go and really travel and see what I really want to do.
It was the first stop, Jaipur?
The first stop, first stop was India, for sure. I'd been to India before.
Uh-huh.
But it wasn't that trip that I actually met the Jain Palace, who I still work with. But I tried to do some jewelry in Indonesia, but I was not convinced with the quality.
Yeah.
It's only when I went back to Jaipur, maybe a year later, and I walked into the Jain Palace stone cutting room, which you've been to it, which is this, everyone is working on the floor, and there's like bags and bags of rough stone that I thought, oh my God, this is such a dream. This is where I want to be.
Yeah.
And I designed a small collection for, which I thought there would be jewelry for myself, maybe a collection of 20 pieces.
Uh-huh.
And I showed it when I came back to my friend, the designer, Lucien Pellafiné, which was called the King of Kashmir at the time.
Yes.
And he said, I love what you did. And you have to show it at Fashion Week.
Mm-hmm.
And I showed it at the Fashion Week that time. I had two appointments. I had an appointment with Bergdorf and one with Barney's. And at the time, I was very lucky that Judy Collinson was still, that was her, the jewelry department was her baby. Mm-hmm. And she saw the collection and she said, I loved it. And my first order was $150,000.
Wow.
And I thought, okay, I have to be in India to do it.
Right. I was going to say you had to move straight back and do that.
And I remember when I went back and I worked on my order, I had done a small necklace with tiny little beads and all the beads were a different color. And Munuka Sliwal from the Jain Palace said, are you sure you want to sit and choose every stone? And I'm like, actually, Munu, I think this is what I love to do. And, you know, and already it had started and I was sitting on my little table because it's like doing a painting. You know, you have all the stones outside of you, around you, and you choose and you mix the color. And every stone, when you choose a stone, you have to make sure that it makes the one next to it looking more beautiful.
Yeah.
Because for me, the treasure of nature, there's nothing more beautiful than what nature makes.
Yeah.
And the stone, if you think about stone, most of the stone, and you know, when you're like walking on the beach or anywhere, they are brown. So when you see a stone which has a color, it's a miracle.
Yeah, it's a miracle.
And so you're like surrounded by all this miracle from nature, and you have to make sure that you don't, you are respectful to them. So I always, you know, there's never an answer when you make a necklace or when you make multicolor, because it's, you know, it's your choice, you know. But still, you have to make sure that you respect every stone and make it more beautiful.
I think about Patrick Blanc, actually, that he said his walls are patented and his he's a botanist. And, you know, you wonder, why are his walls more important than someone else's other than he's a complete genius? But he always said it was because his job and his gift was to choose what plant complemented the one below it and above it and next to it. And I always love that idea.
It's exactly the right word, compliment. This is what I try to do with the stone. I think it's so important to compliment, you know, whatever you put next to it. That, and also the intention that you put when you do things. And that's why I love jewelry, which is made by hand, because, and I love all jewelry because it has a soul. And it, you know, for something to be good, it has to have all the right ingredients. And if everybody loves what they do, then the person who wears it feels that energy.
Yeah.
So with a stone, definitely. And I think with Patrick's work, it's the same. It's a work of love.
Yes.
It has to be a work of love.
An obsession.
An obsession, for sure. And whenever I'm not in the right frame of mind, I will never touch a stone.
Really?
Yeah. Because I'm feeling that, you know, if I'm sad and I'm working on the stone, the person who's going to have that piece of jewelry, they won't know, but maybe they'll feel sad.
Yeah.
I want to give joy, you know, I want to give happiness. I think that's important. You know, we don't need jewelry. We need jewelry because it brings the joy out in us. The beauty brings joy.
Yeah.
And we want to charge it with our energy.
How do you get in the right mindset to work with a stone if you're feeling sad or upset? Do you go for a run or a swim? You're a swimmer.
I think sport, as I get older and with the kind of issue we've had, I realize any kind of exercise is really good to set yourself in the right frame of mind. And it's so important.
Mm-hmm.
We have to do it at least 3-4 times a week. But I would say for me, it's nature. If I don't have that access to nature, I have images. You've never been to my mother's house in the country, but there's a lot of greens and a lot of trees. And I visualize that place, which for me is a healing place, maybe because it's my father's house and I have an attachment to it. I visualize all the tree and the view, and that changed my frame of mind.
Mm-hmm.
I would say flowers also. I always have flowers around me. One time I met someone off, I was saying, you know, when I have a flower bouquet and a TV, I will choose to watch the flowers. I don't know if you do. I'm sure you do that too.
Oh, yeah. I'm so obsessed with it.
Yes. So I think like looking at beauty would change my frame of mind. But I have done been in India. There's definitely a spirituality. And I've done a meditation called Vipassana, which is a very powerful meditation. And for a long time, I used to do 1 hour of meditation. In time of real distress and pain, I would do 2 hours, and it would take the physical pain away, which is what's amazing with meditation. It takes the physical pain away.
Vanessa Friedman from the New York Times described you as the woman who believed stones should be a part of life, as basic as denim, as addictive as silk. Why do you think the idea of stones being a part of everyday life? How did you start to know that? Because it sounds like you didn't get, I mean, Jaipur for sure, but before that, did you have things that were important to you? And did you know that, were they talismans for you? Did you have pieces?
I didn't have so much talisman growing up. And I always loved the idea of wearing stone, but in a much more casual way. But I think it's from working with my clients that I understood that the stone made them very happy. And I try to think, because it's not so much, you know, I don't work with very valuable things. You know, I couldn't understand what it was. I mean, I think it was a connection, instant connection to nature. Mm-hmm. And the stone is something which is, I read somewhere, it's actually the stone that the stars that fell on the earth, which I thought was so beautiful. And it's the way it is. It's a reminder of something much bigger than you, much more beautiful than anything around you. It's an instant connection to something maybe spiritual, I would say. And that's why the woman, especially when they choose a ring, and they often make it into a talisman. It becomes their talisman, their protection. And I think it brings them something special. But the speciality, I mean, it's because it's something which comes from the earth.
Ruth said something last night that I thought was so special, that she said, it's so incredible to see. We've worked with you. You've been sharing your jewels with us for almost 20 years, I guess. Really?
Yes, almost 20 years.
Yeah.
Yes.
We had a lot of mothers and daughters last night, and Ruth was just saying how amazing it is to have shared these things in a family and to know that they will continue in a family, these treasures for the end of time. I mean,
that's the beauty of my of working in jewelry, is that it has a life beyond us.
Yes.
And the jewelry is very sentimental, and as you said, you know, it's often mother and daughter. You've seen the jewelry on your mother, and you know that maybe, well, I mean, eventually one day your mother will not be there, but the jewelry will remind you of your mother.
Yeah.
I suppose when women buy jewelry, they think of that. They think of that it's something that they can give to their children. Mm-hmm. That I have clients who buy a whole, like 4 or 5 kids, and they buy a set for everyone. So they'll start with a ring, and then they buy 4 rings,
yes.
Then they'll buy the earrings, and they'll buy the necklace, because they want to make sure that the day they're no longer there, the children will all have something, and probably the same, yeah. The same thing, so they all share. And that's that makes it very special. Also, if you think about it, many times it's a gift of love, maybe sometimes. It starts with the first, usually it's a grandmother giving the 18th present, mm-hmm. Then it's a boyfriend buying the first present, then it could be the engagement ring, then it is all the birthdays, baptism, yeah. When the first baby is born, mm-hmm. You know, so it's always related to something. And for the children, when they know this is a ring that my mother received when I was born, it's my ring, you know, it makes it special.
It does.
So it takes it much more beyond to from what anything I could create. It's charged with the love of the people who purchase it, and who and that's what makes it special too.
Did you have a mentor or someone that helped you to understand the power of stones?
I had one mentor, which was Lucien Pellafinet, who taught me that you only have to, in life, you should only choose the best, never compromise. Mm. I think you probably have the same mentor. Yes, only the best,
yes.
Only no, quality,
I feel
only
the
best.
And it's not, I don't need...
It doesn't have to be expensive. It's not, it's just,
yes.
If you're buying in quality, it has to be the best.
Yeah.
Then I suppose I had Nikki Butler from Butler & Wilson, who I learned a lot about quality and design, because with costume jewelry, you can be much more free than you can with real jewelry. And I would say my last and most important mentor for stone was Manu Castliwal.
Yeah.
Because he had such an understanding about stones. He would look at rough, mm-hmm. And he would know how to cut it and how to get the beauty out of it. And he had an immense respect for the stone. So I learned that actually a piece of jewelry is created around a stone. Mm-hmm. For me, it's very sad when I see a stone which is cut to go inside the setting.
Yes.
Because I think what's important is to find the stone, because that's what's rare, because it comes from the earth and you can't find it, you know. And then think about how to complement it,
yeah.
You know, how to make it more beautiful. So that's how I've always thought of jewelry. And that's something I learned with Manu. And in India, they have a great respect about stone and about jewelry, because they always say that the skin sees. So the back of the jewelry should be more beautiful, because this is what the skin, you know, appreciate. And that's also something very, very special.
Did you learn about spinels from Manu? I mean, had you known about them before?
Spinel is also my favorite. I remember we used to have a lot of dealers coming from Burma, but the spinel are often mined in the same places as the sapphire. And we had people coming from Burma, and they would actually come with the spinel to Jaipur and swap them for diamonds.
Wow.
Yeah, because there's no diamond in Burma, so they would do the trend. And Manu was fascinated by this stone because of the different colors, yeah. And the way I always love the luster of the spinel, the way it shines is very, very special. And he would buy whatever he could. So he must have had at one point the best collection of spinel. At the time, I didn't have I was just only, you know, I was was just starting, so yeah. I didn't buy enough, and I really regret not buying more. Especially had the most beautiful poppy red, which is my favorite color of Spinel. We had them, but he also was someone who was very mischievous. And we had someone coming in one day and said, you know, I've heard about this very special storm. It's a Spinel. Would you happen to have one? And Munu had been buying all the Spinel. So, and in India, because they're so used to working with stones, they're not so precious about it. So he had next to him a huge plastic, a carrier bag. Full of Spinel. So he put the bag like this and he emptied it on the table. And there must have been like 6,000 carat, a pile, a little mountain of multicolored Spinel. And I thought the guy was going to faint. And of course, we were laughing so much because, you know. But so that's how I got introduced to Spinel. But it's from wearing it that you understand the beauty of it.
And it's exhausted. I mean, there are no more, or is it?
There are more. There are more. And there are some coming from Vietnam also, which have now, I think, the most expensive Spinel. It's a kind of a cobalt blue. I could show you if you come to Paris, but the prices are crazy.
Yeah.
And what's difficult is to find for me is like the red. You know, I'm not a great lover of ruby. I much prefer the red.
The ruby feels sort of dead. Like it's not, it doesn't have a lot of light to it to me. But when you see, we talked about before, I think the crown jewels, the English crown jewels, it's a spinel.
I much prefer the color of the red spinel. That's what I've been collecting, actually. If you ask me, of course, I love tourmaline because there's so many different colors and I love what's inside the tourmaline. But the stone that I have kept for myself, it's always the red spinel.
Really?
I'm always fascinated. Maybe because it's so, I mean, red appeals to me. It's a color which gives me energy. It's a color that I will wear if I'm tired. Mm-hmm. Or if I come back from a trip, and I will always put red. I know it's instant lift of energy. Actually, after having my child, after having Edmond, I had my period where I would be only wearing red.
Really?
A small child takes a lot of energy. Yeah.
Do different colors of spinel give different energies? Or is spinel as a, I don't even know how you would say, just as an object, does it have a certain power? Like, or is a blue spinel a different power than a red spinel?
I think so.
Yeah.
I don't know there is a power of the stone, and there's also, I think, the power of the color. So all the stone in the palette of blue are more soothing. Mm-hmm. Red is something that gives you energy. But but a ruby, for example, which is a stone with a lot of energy, it's not good for people who are too strong. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting. You have to be careful with the energy of the stone. So spinel has the most beautiful lavender color.
Yes.
Like you see today, I'm wearing a lavender spinel, which I love. It's like it's a pink lavender. Mm-hmm. And that's so gentle, so soft.
It's almost like Ayurvedic in that hot personality shouldn't have hot food.
Yes.
It's too much of the same thing that you need to cool yourself.
There was one point where I like diamond is a stone with a very strong energy. It gives you power. For a long time, it was more like in a royal French family, it was the kings and the royal family who were allowed to wear diamond. And if you imagine, I understood one time where there was a power cut and had like a diamond brulee necklace on, and it was all candlelit. If you see the way it shimmers at night, you can see that it can transform a human being into half god. That's why they're also in India, they really used it. You know, the way they dress up. Imagine when they put the Maharaja, put all the diamonds.
Yeah.
And I mean, they had to be rulers, you know, and the diamond, the way they shine, either the sunshine or a candlelit. So that gives you power.
Yeah.
And I had at one point I used to wear diamond a long time back. I can never wear diamond. Huh. It's not what I need.
Yeah.
You know, it's not maybe at one point I needed this to be more assertive in my business and I needed the power of the diamond. Mm-hmm. But now I shy away from it. It's not my mood. I'm much more wearing. Sapphire is a stone for success. Huh. Sapphire is one of the stones I love too. Again, very delicate palette. It comes from the same mine as a spinel. Uh-huh. Lots of beautiful colors. Huh. And it's very gentle, I find. And it's a stone that traditionally is the engagement ring in Europe because it helps you being faithful, is good in
right?
a marriage.
Yeah. Yes,
that helps a marriage a lot. But also it's good, it binds people together. Huh. I love for emerald. Emerald is the stone. Okay, it's a fragile stone, as we know. People are always worried about wearing emerald, but if it's given by someone who loves you, it's enhanced love.
Mm.
So I think that's quite beautiful too.
Yeah. Will you talk a little bit about Paraiba?
Paraiba. Paraiba is one of my favorite stones.
And you have the most beautiful collection. Yes, find the best.
I've been collecting for a long time, but I was fascinated. The first one I saw was in Tucson, I think in 96 or 97. And it was coming from the Paraíba mine in Brazil. And it's a color which can go from a swimming pool blue, which is supposed to be the best color. Mm-hmm. But it's too electric for me. It's too, you know, it's the wrong shade of turquoise. You know what I mean about the wrong shade of turquoise? And it can go towards more of a greeny blue, which is like a lagoon or the sea from the south. Mm-hmm. So it's so beautiful. It has a lot of copper in the stone, which it's what defines the Paraíba is the copper contents. Mm-hmm. And the copper makes it very iridescent, very shiny. And it's a really, really beautiful stone.
And when you talk a little bit about inclusions, they're copper. Are they copper inclusions, I guess? And what is an inclusion?
An inclusion. So if you call it an inclusion, people think, oh my God, it's not a good stone. But in fact, in the tourmaline, especially the Paraíba, it's the way the light reflects or hits the inclusion and comes out again. For me, they're like a little sequence or a little, sometimes I see a rainbow. For me, it's the most beautiful thing. Yeah. But when you choose a stone, and I think what's important first is that the stone has life. Mm-hmm. That's what we say in the business. You have to pick a stone that's alive, that speaks to you. Exactly. The world is like you should choose a stone that speaks to you. But when you have an inclusion, which I think many times it makes the stone much more attractive than a stone which is completely clean, because that could look like a piece of glass. Many times I see stone, like very expensive stone, they have no charm.
Yeah.
You know, the beauty is that inclusion. It's mm-hmm. a charm that it gives it. You have to make sure that the inclusion does not disturb you. So it's not, you know, if you have an inclusion right in the center of the table, this is not something you should actually even consider. So some inclusion are very attractive and really adds to the stone, and some inclusion just, makes it like, you know, you don't want to go there. It's not attractive.
And talk to me about the process of choosing stones. I mean, do you just get a feeling in your body of what?
So choosing stone, I get a feeling, the first feeling I get when the stone dealer come, traditionally they still use a little paper envelope.
Yeah.
So you don't know what's going to come. So I get excited like a kid in a candy store, because I don't know what I'm going to find.
Yeah.
And it's a constant process of a treasure hunt, which is what makes it really exciting, because I don't know what's been coming out of the earth. I don't know what I'm going to find. And all those packets are white and I don't know what's in them. So my heart starts beating faster for sure. And then you open the packets and you will see, and some, and many stones are not, I mean, they're not all beautiful. Mm-hmm. And then suddenly you see some that speak to you and that seem to be magical and alive and are special. But to tell you why, I don't know, but people always say that my stones are very vibrant. Mm-hmm. So I suppose I like, I like when they're very alive. It's something that Munu taught me. It was interesting when I started, not many people were using tourmaline, and I used a lot of multicolored tourmaline when I started. And he always explained to me, it's better to get the best quality tourmaline than a poor quality sapphire. Because what's important is the way it's alive, the way it's the luster, the way it shines, the way it reacts on your skin. And that is something that maybe not many classic jeweler would say.
I was because gonna say Western.
Yeah.
Did it take a while for you to unwind your thinking about, you know, sapphires, emeralds, rubies instead of tourmalines?
So I think my greatest asset is I didn't come from a family of jeweler.
Yeah.
So I didn't have that.
Yeah.
I just I look at the stone because they were beautiful. I didn't think, okay, a sapphire is more beautiful than a spinel or a tourmaline. I just chose what I love, and I didn't mind mixing it. You know, I've mixed precious and semi-precious and not worried about it. And I've always, respected what Munu said. You have to choose the best of the stone. It doesn't matter if it's a sapphire, an emerald, or a ruby, or semi-precious. Mm-hmm. And I would recommend anyone who buys a stone, they should do that. If you get a blue sapphire, which is too dark, which is dead, and it's your engagement ring, it's not never going to make you happy. You need to buy something. It's better to buy something, you know, less precious, but which is more happier, more vibrant.
Yeah. My sister just got engaged, and it's green tourmalines. It's the most beautiful, bright, happy, and it really does feel like that. It feels like this promise for the rest of your life.
that's why I feel the clients, they really cherish earrings, because you can see it. I always tell the client, if they don't know if they should choose earrings or rings, rings and bracelet will give you the most pleasure. But because you will look at the stone all the time.
Yeah.
You know, and suddenly the light will hit it and you will suddenly think, oh my God, this is so beautiful. And when you wear earrings, it's very decorative. It brings light to the face. Necklace, it will bring it. It has an instant cosmetic effect. Mm. But it's for the pleasure of others.
Yeah.
When you wear rings, it's really for your own pleasure.
I love that.
Yeah. And maybe engagement, maybe that's why it's an engagement ring. Also, yeah. the finger where you put your engagement ring on is directly related to your heart,
yes.
You know, the meridian of the heart.
Yes.
So that's probably why traditionally that's we put it on this finger.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah.
What stones do you love to wear for protection?
Protection, the stone that protects you the most is a lapis, is a blue lapis. It was used by the Egyptian.
Yeah.
And it's the color and the energy of the stone. Mm-hmm. And it says that only a pure heart can wear a lapis.
Ooh.
And it's very interesting because a lot of people shy away from lapis.
Yeah, no, they do.
Yeah.
And for
me, lapis is something which, it has those little freckles of gold inside. It's so beautiful. And sometimes it has black freckles and it makes me think of the sky at night with all the stars. It has something really magical. It's an opaque stone. Mm-hmm. And generally, I tend to go more for a clear stone with inclusion and, more things going on inside. But lapis is the one I would recommend for protection.
And you cut yours. I mean, you cut them like a classic stone. It's so beautiful.
I love a cut stone.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I cut even normally you cut a stone because you want to add light to it.
Mm.
But I love to cut even a lapis. It gives it something else, all the facets. It makes it more special, I find.
Yeah. I'm a breast cancer survivor. And when I was recovering, I would not take my necklace off that you made me. Almost 20 years ago, really.
Yeah.
And I always love the stones to touch my skin, and it goes straight down to near the breast. Yeah. but I always, it was really important to me at that time. Is there a stone for healing that you love?
The healing stone. I'm a breast cancer survivor too.
Yep.
And I would say that we learn a lot from, what we go through, and
yeah.
it makes us stronger and wiser.
Okay. I learned a lot from you. I mean, it was interesting because you were a couple years ahead of me, but I really learned a lot from you. And because I'd grown up with it in my life, just your strength and dignity.
I think the breast cancer that we go through, or we've been through, is like a metamorphosis. I felt like I was, how would you say, before the butterfly, chrysalid? What do you say
yeah,
in English?
Chrysalis.
And it made me grow into a butterfly. And, I used to have my long hair and I had to cut my hair off.
Yeah.
I was, I was quite busty. And the breast cancer touched your femininity,
Yeah.
And that's why it's so difficult. But the surgeon explained to me that surgeon related to my family, she said, you should not worry about it because it's not dangerous, because it's outside your ribs. It's not internal organs. So already, because when we get operated, we have this fear that something is going to go very wrong. But in fact, when you think about it, the breast is decorative.
Yes, it is.
Once we've had our children,
Before
the children, it has a purpose, but after the children, it's decorative. And it doesn't define us. And so it's a process. And I think this process makes us stronger and more beautiful. And it's in suffering that actually we relate more to people. And, I learned a lot and I never think about it these days. I'm just... different.
Yeah. No, I feel the same way until I just started talking to you.
The stone and the color I recommend for anyone who's going through this transformation, this illness, is green tourmaline.
Oh.
Green tourmaline is a healing stone. So pyrite is probably a healing stone too. Any green, because it's a color of nature and it's a color of renewal. I love in spring, like when you see all the shades of green in the countryside, I think that's a healing. And that's what we should see. And I feel hospitals should always have windows onto trees. And that's what helps us heal. It's this thing that, you know, when you look at nature, it goes completely dry in winter and it's dark and it's black and suddenly it blooms again.
Yeah.
And it's what we need to believe when we think that we're going to bloom again.
Yeah.
We have the strength and we can make ourselves bloom again.
You know, one thing that's really interesting too, from knowing you for so long, I was attracted to such a different stone when I first met you. And as I've, and you're right, like as your life twists and turns, you become a different person. And I do think I'm attracted to completely different stones than I ever was before.
So it's a very interesting process. And when people ask me, should I wear my astrological stone? And I feel, okay, maybe it's good when you were born, but we evolve all the time. And we should trust our intuition when we choose things, when we choose color, when we choose stone. Because when I have the time and I know the person well and their situation at that moment, I find that the stone they choose is always the right stone for them. I mean, the property of the stone is always the right stone for their emotional state.
Yeah.
So I totally understand that, you know, we are attracted, as I was telling you about the diamond that I used to wear, yeah, well, maybe my business started and I had to be stronger. we need different things at different time, and we shouldn't be set in our own way, and we should trust our instinct. Yeah. And we should definitely trust our instinct when we are buying stone. I'm always amazed when I see young girls. They always choose rose quartz, and rose quartz is a stone that not only gives you confidence, which we all need at 16, 17, 18, because it's actually a very difficult time. But it also, if you had a difficult childhood, and you know, childhood is not always easy, it helps you heal your childhood. But they don't know that. And they will pick a rose quartz.
Wow.
A pregnant woman, many times, ladies who want to get pregnant, they will pick flower opal. Flower opal is related to your hormonal system and it's related to the base chakra, and it helps you getting pregnant. So I'm not saying it works, but, you know, I also really believe in the placebo effect, but I've seen it happening. But I've seen people choosing without telling me anything about it. It's only when I know about it a little. And it's fascinating. People who go through depression will choose a smoky quartz. You know, it's like this brown quartz. Mm-hmm. It heals depression.
Really?
Yeah. Amethyst. I've seen people were trying amethyst necklaces on. And the amethyst, I mean, this one, I really started believing in the power of the stone and thinking there's something much more that I could not explain, but that you see, they would put amethyst necklace on and the amethyst would go hot. And I tried the same necklace and on me, there was no reaction, but to a point where they could not wearing, but it was boiling hot. Amethyst is a stone, which was always worn by the church, the cardinal, because it helps you from getting any kind of intoxication, and it helps you from having strong desires, and it protects you. The name comes from the Greek, and it's the color of the wine, and it really helps you with addiction with alcohol. And I felt the people who had tried the necklaces on and it got hot were people who had issues with alcohol.
Yeah.
And it was like taking something away from them.
Huh.
It was incredible.
That's amazing.
You know, if I had not experienced it myself, I would not believe it. I've had the necklace in my hand. It was boiling hot. You could not wear it. People who had a problem with alcohol had probably all their energy, their vital energy, you know, the energy of the chi. And then when they went to the acupuncture, then the acupuncture, you know, kind of did something so the energy flowed again. But the amethyst was taking that energy, was helping them out.
Wow.
So. In life, trust your instinct. You know, listen to that little voice before the stone buying, before not taking that flight, or before, you know. What's complicated is you have to know when it's a voice
right,
and when it's your mind.
We always ask about prom, and we've already talked to you, but is there a stone that you love more than anything in your life?
So I always think, what would I do if my house was on fire? What would I take? And I think I would try to grab my jewelry pouch.
Yeah.
I suppose, which stone? I have a stone which I don't wear very often, which is a pink sapphire, which has no setting. I love when the stone is not set. Mm-hmm. I think that's the purest way to wear a stone, and it's the most beautiful way, but we have to drill it. Right. So when you're drilling it, the inclusion has to be in a certain way so it doesn't show.
Yeah.
And that would be, if the stone is too incredible, too pure, I would feel like I can't do that to the stone. Mm. But the stone I would love the most, it's a very delicate pink, which is the color of, I call it candy pink, but it's a bit of the color of a bubble gum. Mm. And it's a sapphire, and I believe it brings me luck. Mm. And I love that stone, but it's fragile, and I've fallen one time wearing it, so I'm worried to wear it all the time.
Yeah.
That would be the one thing that I cherish the most.
Thank you so much. What We Wore is produced by Capital and Balto Creative Media. The original song, Someone So Enchanting, was composed and performed by Britt Drazda. QueenCityPodcastNetwork.com.